You're listening to Bedroom Beethovens, where notable music makers break down stories accompanied by songs and melodies documenting growth through their 10,000-hour journey. And me? Well, my name is Cello, your host.
I am a bedroom Beethoven.
Hey everybody, welcome to episode 145 of the podcast. My guest this week is...
My name is Josh Karp. I go by the name of Budo. I've been producing and playing music for most of my life. Some of the folks I've worked with include Macklemore, Doja Cat, Kesha, Greaves, Atmosphere. Yeah, those are the ones that kind of pop to mind right now.
I was thinking about the bands. I was thinking about the fans. We were underground, loading merch in that 12-passenger van in a small club in Minnesota, and the snow outside of First Ave. I just wanted my name in the star. Now look at where we at, still growing up. Still growing up. I would lay in my bed and dream about what I'd become. Couldn't wait to get older. Couldn't wait to be some. Now that I'm here, wishing I was still young.
Multi-instrumentalist, composer, recording artist, producer, and touring musician, insert title, etc. Man of a thousand talents. Budo swings by to talk about being raised on a steady diet of Sam Cooke, Miles Davis, and grunge music, and explains how he manages to combine an incredible array of disparate influences to create a unique tapestry of textures, rhythms, and sounds that add a new dimension to just about everything he touches. From Roger Lyon to Greaves to Macklemore himself, a childhood and adolescence spent committed to both the formal study of trumpet and music theory, as well as an informal pursuit of as many other instruments he could get his hands on, the results is the golden era of rhymesayers, Grammy Awards, and platinum records, all while repping the great city of Seattle. I have to be honest with you guys, as we head towards the end of the year, I feel myself slowing down. I'm very hesitant to announce that I feel like quitting, because then you'll get just messages of like, hey, don't quit, keep going. But sometimes, you know, I feel like it's okay to quit. And, as we head towards the end of the year, I just feel myself slowing down a bit. I'm not sure if I'll be churning out new episodes on a consistent basis. I don't know if I'm feeling a bit of podcast fatigue. I'm not sure what it will lead to. I don't want to quit, but it is hard to maintain a weekly schedule nowadays. But it's not all doom and gloom, because I still enjoy sharing these stories and I enjoy the community that surrounds the show. All my Patreons, everybody that emails me. But, you know, just a tiny reminder, this podcast is available where all podcasts can be found. That's Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher. Leave a comment, subscribe on YouTube, all that good stuff. And I'm going to be releasing some classic episodes on the feed, and I'll be back later this month with some fresh episodes. But in the meantime, again, welcome the man of the hour, Budo, whose trumpet lines float through the most intimate vocal melodies, weaving tales of heartbreak, hope, and sadness. Hope everyone is safe out there. Thanks for tuning in. Here we go.
I wish somebody would have told me that someday these would be the good old days. All the love you forget, and all these reckless nights you regret.
I think the biggest compliment that I can afford you is that you are a true multi-instrumentalist. Like, you play it all. And in fact, I saw on 88 Keys and Counting that you used a son's grand piano, which is essentially a Steinway, which costs, I don't know, $80,000. But then you also use a $10 trumpet as well. So it's true what they say. It's not how much an instrument costs. It's how you use it.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I don't really give a shit where the instrument comes from or what, you know, the value of it or whatever. It's just sort of how it feels and how it plays. And I actually, I remember that at Steinway, while we were recording the record in this tiny little studio in Fort Collins, Colorado, which is where Grease is from. And yeah, it's just a beautiful instrument. It felt good. It played well. And yeah, it definitely made its way onto the record.
Can you tell me what it's like growing up in Seattle? Because it's got a really good musical creative history. You know, 79 years ago, Jimi Hendrix was born there, and Ray Charles arrived in Seattle as a teenager to escape the nightmare of Jim Crow in the South. So there's a lot of musical history rooted in that area.
Yeah, it runs deep here. It's funny. I was just my uncle has this just incredible record collection, and he's been sort of sending me. He's like offloading it to me, like piece by piece. So every once in a while, I'll just open the door, and there's like, you know, 50 or 60 records just sitting there waiting for me to open up. And we were talking yesterday, and he sent me a record, which is actually like it just came out, but it's a double LP of John Coltrane playing A Love Supreme. Like, it's the only time it ever got played live, and it was here in Seattle. There was just like a crazy collection of jazz clubs here in the city that aren't here anymore, but really, like, there was just a scene here that I think was pretty special. And yeah, I mean, growing up here, I don't know. I was a kid in the early 90s, like Nirvana were my heroes. Like, it was you had this feeling that you were surrounded by something really, really special and unique, and something that I think, because it's a small city and because you know, we don't have the sort of infrastructure and scene that a place like Los Angeles or New York or Atlanta does, like, there's just things that happen here feel special, and they feel like they are a part of the city in a way that got into my blood at an early age. Like, it just, I felt, and I still do, I feel very, very proud to be from here. I feel very proud to have participated and been a part of the music scene here. And it just, I don't know. Yeah. Just from a very early age, it felt like we were in a very special place as far as music and art goes.
Well, correct me on the pronunciation. I think places like, what was it? Lake Winnipesaukee.
Yeah, yeah. Man. Shit.
That had some meaning to you too, right?
Yeah. Lake Winnipesaukee is up in New Hampshire. My family ran a summer camp for Jewish kids up in New England. I was in a family for 50 or 60 years, and it was on the shore of Lake Winnipesaukee. So we go up there most every summer and spend months at a time. So yeah, that's a really special place.
It's funny that you mentioned like grunge music having an effect on you. Grunge was formed in Aberdeen, which is like 2 hours from Seattle. You got to head south through Tacoma, but that's where Kurt Cobain created Nirvana. And of course, the Foo Fighters, Dave Grohl's from there as well. So Washington just has this musical origin story of all the greats, it seems.
It's fucking dark here. It's rainy. It's miserable for a good 6 to 7 months of the year. And that does two things. I think, A, it, like, you know, it forces people to go inside. Like, you can't, there's only so much you can do outdoors for a lot of the year here. And so if you're, you know, if you're a kid and you're locked in your room, like, there's a good chance that at some point you're going to start, you know, fucking around with music, and you have the time and energy and sort of focus to be able to do that here. And then also, like, it just, there's a degree of, this shit is depressing. So it can bring out a sort of an emotional connection with yourself and the sort of darker parts of yourself in a way that I think really does breed good music and good art.
Yeah, I was blown away because I saw that COVID-19 Washington concert last year, and I was like, holy shit, Pearl Jam's from Seattle, Dave Matthews lives in Seattle, and then I see your name, I see Prometheus Brown's names. I mean, like, that's incredible. And I was just thinking, like, how at one point was Seattle not the hotbed for networking? You know, forget New York, set up shop in Seattle. That's where it's at.
Yeah, you know, I think the issue here is that there is not, unless you're in a band and are touring and able to connect outside of, like, there just isn't a music industry here. There's no infrastructure, and there's no real blueprint for, particularly as a producer. Like, it just, you know, you go to LA and there's just, you know, I could work with a different artist every day of the week there. And here, because there's a limited kind of pool of folks that are working like that, it just, it's hard to sit here and really dream. And I think that's why there's like a lot of people that have come out of Seattle, but it's very, very hard to sort of make it here without leaving. And yeah, it's sort of like an interesting, like the bands and artists that have made it here are not bands and artists that have ever considered themselves sort of local. like they're ones that have really gotten a van or gotten an airplane and gotten out of the city.
Yeah, I remember when you and Greaves were on the Winners and Losers tour, he just moved to California and he was so excited that in between each song, he was like, "Hey guys, I'm in California now. What's up? I'm in California." So those back then, that's just what you did.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it still is to a large degree. And there's a few folks here that have obviously been able to stay and still have a flourishing career, but it's most people have to leave.
Yeah, but I even read like the middle schools are progressive. Like in 1995, if you're taking an electronic music class, that's progressive because that wasn't even a big genre at the time, unless you had some weird oddball teacher who listened to Orbital all day. You were never going to be exposed to that kind of music at that age.
No, it's some Aphex Twin fans in the faculty. Yeah, no, it was interesting. I don't, to this day, I don't really know what the fuck that was doing there. It must have been some ex-student that had excess of money in their bank account and a pension for early electronic music. But yeah, man, that shit was awesome. I remember sitting down at like probably one of the earliest versions of Cubase on like one of these old Apple II computers. And that was probably older than Apple II computer. It was old as shit. And just the magic of being able to sit down at a MIDI keyboard and like play the French horn and play the piano and play the drums and play, you know, the upright bass and do it all myself and do it all inside of a computer was mind-blowing. And obviously now that's how most music gets made, but at the time it was just like, I don't know, blew my mind.
Yeah, the only thing that I can say that I kind of relate to that is like I remember my mom, she bought me Prodigy's Fat of the Land because it was a crab on the art cover and she thought it would be a fun album. Yeah, so I'm like, I'm 10 listening to like Smack My Bitch Up and it could have went south.
That shit's heavy, man. That shit was very heavy.
Yeah, and I wouldn't recommend.
That's intense music.
It's intense, right? And I wouldn't recommend any parent go out and buy their 10-year-old that. But you know what? It did open up my taste of music quite a bit.
Totally.
I didn't know what I was in for. I pop in the CD that has a crab on the cover and I'm like, what am I listening to?
This sounds nothing like the ocean.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So if you had the tools to make music at this time, I'm talking about the middle school era, you would have had a 5-6 year head start on producing. Did you ask anyone on like your birthday or Christmas, like, I want an MPC? You know, it might have changed the trajectory of the music that you made, perhaps.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I think likely because of my early encounter with computer-based music, like I make music as much visually as I do do by ear. And so it's always been very hard for me to sit down at like an MPC or an ASR and like put things together in a way that feels right. Like I have to kind of see, I have to see the blocks of MIDI and I have to see the arrangement like of the different tracks and different colors and layers sort of right in front of me for it to all make sense. As far as when I'm sort of producing and composing. So yeah, I think it definitely would have, if I had first encountered production via an MPC or an ASR versus via like a computer screen, I think it would have been a very different experience. It definitely changed the way that I approach music for sure.
Were you listening to more like Sebadoh or New Radiant Storm King than hip hop? So maybe having an MPC, I don't know, maybe it wasn't even on the radar back then.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Like my parents gave me a 4-track tape cassette recorder, like a little Tascam, I think it was a 488. And that was my first encounter with recorded music. And that was at a time, you know, I was young, I was probably 6th, 7th grade. And because of my family over in the East Coast, like it was this crazy scene of like kind of, well, it's actually interesting. There was all these bands from Amherst, like, I think it's Northeast Massachusetts, but like Amherst is a college town a few hours outside of Boston. And there was a bunch of bands that came out of there that I really loved. And a lot of those bands were on Sub Pop Records, which was based in Seattle. And so I would go downtown. There was a Sub Pop Records store where they would sell all of the records that Sub Pop made. And so I'd go down there and like sift through records and buy a 7-inch or buy a tape cassette or a CD or something and come home and listen to it. And then I would sit down at the, and a lot of that music was like super lo-fi and made on 4-track tape cassette recorders. And so I'd like listen to like a Sebadoh record that was like grimy and hard to understand and distorted and shit, but like felt really good. And then I would try to do the same thing myself with the 4-track tape cassette recorder that I had in my room. So that was actually before the computer shit. That was sort of my first, and it was it's fucking nuts. You know, like you could play the guitar and then you could record another guitar on top of that guitar. And then you, you know, record yourself singing really terribly on top of those two guitars. And then you could take those three tracks and bounce those down to the fourth and then make another three tracks. And each time you did it, the sound got worse and worse and worse and worse until you had 14 or 16 or 20 tracks that all just, it was fucking unintelligible, but it was still like, just, you know, you're playing around. It was, I don't know. It's sort of those formative, encounters with the process of recording that's super, super important.
And then, you know, so you're experimenting with music, you find your footing in music, and now it's kind of like almost a career. You know, you're touring with Grease for 4 or 5 years, and then you found yourself mentally exhausted to the point where you were contemplating if you even wanted to continue making music. And we're in a new time, you know, with COVID, so there is no tour exhaustion. And young producers may never know the plight of travel fatigue if things never go back to normal. So how is this going to change things for music? Or maybe even more personally, like, how's it going to change for you? Is this a good thing?
Yeah, is COVID a good thing? I don't think I can answer that. But I think that as far as it's concerned, I mean, shit has changed. Shit changed way before COVID. I mean, we're in an era now where artists break on the internet, primarily on the internet, versus when, you know, say Greaves and I were on the road and trying to create an audience and create a career. Like, the only way that we knew how to do that, and really the only way that made sense to do it, was to get in a band and just go and play, you know, in front of 5 people and then 10 people. And then the same 5 people bring another 5 people. And then, you know, you sort of start this snowball effect. That's really like a hand to hand, like, kind of combat. And now you have to build momentum via, like, through the internet. Like, people haven't been touring in the same way. And I think there's a lot of reasons why that's happened. I think there's a lot of, like, corporate interests that have come in and bought up a lot of smaller clubs and are sort of controlling this, like, vertical stack of, like, you know, like the touring infrastructure from the 100 person venues to the 10,000 person venues, and those promoters and booking agents are intimately tied to, like, the label system. And it's really, really hard for independent artists to break through that shit unless you are adept at utilizing, you know, the marketing tools of the internet to gain an audience. And so, and I think a lot of this started with SoundCloud. Anyway, people aren't touring the way that they used to. And I think that predates COVID, but COVID has certainly accelerated that to the point where, like, you know, it's impossible to get on the road now. And so artists are forced to get really creative with the way that they market themselves and build audiences. And I don't think it's good or bad. I mean, I definitely, there's something for me really important about the way that we did it, which was really, really physical. Like, just getting on the road and putting your body on the line like that, like, really forces you to decide whether or not this is something that is really important to you, in a way that, like, posting a TikTok video does not sort of test you in the same way.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's a bad thing at all. I think it's just a different, we're in a different era, you know?
I know you kind of chuckled when I asked that question. It seems silly on the surface, but, you know, I was wondering, like, I can't go up to the Physics or the Blue Scholars or Common Market or Gifted Youngsters and ask them why music isn't a long-term viable option for them anymore. I was thinking maybe their feelings mirrored how you felt in Brooklyn at the time. Maybe they didn't want to do it anymore. The touring, the headaches, the airports.
Yeah, it's a young man's game for sure. Unless you're able to break through into the upper echelon of it, where you are being taken care of well. But even that, like, you're just, you know, let's say you're fucking Dave Matthews or whatever. You're in a beautiful bus and on a beautiful plane, but you're still away from home and you're jet lagged and you're waking up at 6 a.m. to get to the next place. And that can only, unless you're, you know, made of steel, like, that really, that can't last forever, you know? So there is, I think there's an exhaustion built into that.
And it was bad timing across the board, because I mean, you got married right before the pandemic. You didn't know the pandemic was going to happen, so I mean, that must have affected the honeymoon phase of things.
Yeah, man, it's actually been great. It was a real test. Like, you know, you get married and you get locked in a house with your wife for a couple of years. But it's been fucking great, man. It's really we really have enjoyed spending the time together. And I mean, we have a kid now that he was born during the pandemic, so that was certainly a testament to the fact that we were doing pretty well together. So
yeah, for sure. I have a 7-year-old daughter who now wearing masks everywhere we go is the new normal.
Yeah,
so I'm in it.
I know. For sure.
Now people might associate you with platinum selling records, but you're still a bedroom Beethoven, because Gemini was created, it wasn't created in a fancy studio, it was more so like in a basement, right? And the next thing you know, it blew up, and now you're performing at the Grammys.
You know, Ben and I started working together in 2003, maybe. That was way before things got to where they've gotten to. And we made records like in his one bedroom apartment in Olympia, and in my dorm room in Walla Walla, and then in various like hovels and apartments and houses and dirty ass places like in, you know, in Seattle and in New York and shit over the course of the next few years. And so there was no, you know, for us, it's always been it's sort of shiny, you know, we get in a room, we make music together, and there's not a focus on doing anything in a grand way. It's just, you know, really, I mean, to this day, it feels like, you know, some friends getting together and making music. And so the setting is not super important. It's more just the connection of it all.
See, you know that, and I know that. And I was wondering, like, why do journalists or music outlets, they never recognize the falling off your shoes tour days? Like, you've been with Macklemore for so long.
That's probably a reason.
Yeah. Well, but when you read a headline that reads, Gemini is a career reset because Ryan Lewis isn't there, he's going out on his own. And it's like, you guys don't understand, like, the platinum plaques with Macklemore happened because of the chemistry that you guys have established for almost two decades now. But nobody ever writes a story about that.
Yeah. And to be completely frank with you, I don't really give a shit. Like, to me, there's a narrative that's necessary in order to sell things that I understand. And that narrative benefits everybody when that narrative helps to sell those things. And so I don't care how people interpret it. I don't care how media or fans or anything, like, you know, sees me or doesn't see me or understands the sort of intricacies of those interpersonal relationships or the long-term shit. Like, I know, you know, like, I know what I've done. I know the connections I've made, and I know the time that I put into this shit. And I also know the things that I get out of it, which are amazing records that open doors and connect me to other people and allow me to make more amazing records. I mean, the thing that matters to me, to be honest with you, is the people that I respect and want to work with know what I've done and who I am and the value that I bring in a room. And I have every confidence that those people know that. And so I'm honestly not tripping about any of the rest of the shit.
Fill my lungs up, pull my heart out, peel my bones away. Grab my window, shed my shadow, excavate my pain.
Hold me up into the light, study every part of me. I'm an open book, no, I don't mind, cause sometimes I'm hard to read. Just flesh and bone, I'm headed home, but this life is so hard to leave. But who am I when they cut the lights and nobody's watching me? Gemini.
The controversy of Macklemore winning the Grammy over Kendrick, if I drill down, and I think really there was a big conversation around whether or not you guys should even been best rap album, because there's X amount of pop sensibilities and moments in the production. And it's like, it alienates itself from the rest of his peers. So I'm like, how do you approach that? Do you see Glorious or Good Old Days as pop beats, as rap beats, or do you see it as just genreless? Like, we're making good music.
You know, it's not like the Macklemore team was able to break into the Grammy voting system and like rig the ballots in order to like win that particular genre. Like, that shit happens because of how the world, because of how journalists and the world sort of interprets and categorizes things. And that's a much broader, like, sort of systemic thing that's important to understand and deal with. But that is not, that is not the responsibility of the artist in sort of question there. So I think that's an important distinction to make. And then also, like, yeah, I mean, your question about like how I view the music I make and how I view the music I make with artist A versus artist B, like, again, yeah. And I mean, I don't care. Like, I'm in a room, I'm trying to help the artist there make the best song that they can make and realize like the vision that they're trying to realize. And if that includes raps, awesome. If that includes singing, awesome. If that includes both, awesome. Like, and if that includes like a grimy ass, like, you know, neck snapping, like slapping beat, like, fuck yeah. If that includes like a really, you know, thoughtfully structured and intentionally arced like piece of music that would fall inside of like a pop genre, like, fuck yeah. Like, I don't care. I love all of it. And there's a time and place for all of it.
But if you take a step back, you're looking at like, well, Yeezus, wasn't that a pop album? And now it's okay for a rapper to make pop music. It didn't get any flack. Maybe because Kanye West
fucking,
is black.
Fucking, you know? Gold Digger was a pop record. Like, all, you know, Kanye has been making pop records from the jump. And Kanye has understood both the value of like melody as a means of connecting with like a different part of the heart. The distinction between rap and pop rap is a little ridiculous, I would say.
Perfect word for it. Yeah.
Yeah.
But getting back to Seattle though, did you have some good times at the pharmacy? Did you record any music there?
You know, I went to the pharmacy a couple of times. That place is legendary though. I mean, yep. Vitamin is, I believe Vitamin D is the greatest beat maker to ever come out of Seattle, hands down. He's our Dilla. Like, he's an innovator. He's somebody with a unique ear and a really unique sense of swing and he's a genius. He understands like dynamics and taste. Like, he's a genius. He's got a lot of good stories.
Yeah, Gift of Gab, RIP. He recorded Fourth Dimensional Rocket Ships Going Up there at the pharmacy.
Yeah.
So a lot of stuff. I wanted to talk about Bird on a Wire because it's one of your earlier tattoos and the name of an album. What about your life made that imagery powerful enough to have it be such a lasting mark in your life? I have a theory, and you can tell me if I'm way off, but my guess, it's about living dangerously, because birds can be electrocuted perching on wires, but they have the freedom to leave anytime they want and fly away. So there's always that risk. Am I way off?
That's fucking brilliant. No, that you are way off, but that's amazing. No, I'd just gone through a breakup and I was feeling lonely, and that's pretty much that.
I was way off. Wow.
I know. I should have. Had we known each other then?
If you could repeat the origin story of Roger Lyon with another artist, where you admire someone from afar, but now you reach out and you connect and form a duo, but it's 2021. Who would you choose and why?
Oh man, that is a great question. That's a good question. I think probably Beth Gibbons of Portishead. That would be so fun. That's my answer.
You create a song like The Adulterer's Mustache, and you could feel it's a better song than Good Old Days. Or maybe you put more time into that song than Good Old Days. And the fruits of that labor don't deliver on like a mainstream level. Do you just play the game? Do you get frustrated that the indie projects don't get as much shine as the major label stuff? I'm guessing I know what you're going to say, but I am curious because like, I listen to Roger Lyon. I think it's great. But you say things like, I'm sharing a pillar of the foundation of my musical life with you. The way this came together is preordained. It's meant to be. And it gets 1/1000th of the look a Macklemore record gets. And you're giving, it sounds like you're just giving so much of yourself. As good as 20,000 times. Words will not console.
Nothing wipes away. I do not apply a value judgment to that versus something like the Joe Pernice record or Roger Lyon. I'm as proud of Good Old Days as I am of The Adulterer's Mustache. and I put as much of myself in each one of those, or I put the same amount of myself in each one of those. It's just in a different way. And you know, do I wish the world like loved and appreciated Joe as much as I do? Definitely. Am I surprised that that's how it goes? Like, no. And is, you know, is there like a palate or an appetite from like a mass audience for a, like a minute long, like instrumental piece with like a trumpet as like the lead vocal? Like, no. will there ever be? Like, probably not. Is that a tragedy? No. I think that, you know, look, like, I mean, take finances and fame and ego out of the equation. Like, my favorite thing in the entire world was to go down when I was a kid to that Sub Pop record store and find a record that like no one had ever heard before, or that I thought no one had ever heard before, and that I felt like was this like secret thing that I had uncovered and then developed a relationship with. And so I think that that is a very, very important thing. And is, yeah, it's just the way the world works, man. It's not a problem. It is a shame in some ways that it's so much great art, and more so these days than it used to. Like, you think about the number of the tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of songs that get released every single day. You know, I guarantee you that there's hundreds of those that are amazing that, you know, more than 100 people over here. And that is a product of the sort of information, like, onslaught that we all live in. So I do think there's something lost in that, but generally speaking, like, no, I think it's just fine.
That's good.
It's,
yeah.
Not, yeah. Yeah.
Cause I was thinking, I had this terrible analogy where I was thinking that you're kind of like Robert Pattinson, where, you know, he could do Twilight, which affords him the opportunity to make a bunch of indie films like The Lighthouse or Water for Elephants or The Lost City of Z, and then come back and do The Batman. And I was thinking, well, maybe he's the same way. Like, he can make a radio hit and then he can go back and work with Soul or Ben Zaidi or whoever. And I was thinking maybe that was a good position to be in. But then I was thinking, like, man, then he's making music with a monetary value attached to it before it's even done. And that's no way to be a producer.
No. But also, you know, this is my life. This is my career. This is how I keep the lights on. And so, so the money part is not bad. And it's not something that I take lightly or scoff at, or yeah. But yeah, I mean, to your point, like, the records that make money allow me to spend time with things that might not have the same potential upside, financially speaking.
And I think that's a good segue to, because I want to allow you to have the floor to tell the audience kind of what you have on in the horizon. If, you know, if you've been kind of locked in your house for a year with COVID, like, what kind of cool stuff do you have brewing? So you have the floor.
Ben and I have been working pretty heavily on a bunch of Macklemore stuff. So that will, that'll see the light of day at some point. And I'm excited about a lot of it. I've been, I've just been experimenting a lot with like writing hooks and yeah, just like pushing into that side of things. So there's a lot that's kind of a part of that record that that I have. I just take a lot of pride in. So that's been a big part of things. I'm working right now on a record with an artist up here from Seattle named Claudine Magbag, who's just a phenomenal singer, writer, and person. And so I think she will have a record that'll come out sometime next year that we worked really closely on, and I definitely think it's something special. I've been working with an artist who lives in LA named Asia, who is also just a phenomenal talent, just crazily creative and vulnerable and just an amazing songwriter. And so that music I feel really cool about. What else? I've been going back and forth to LA for years, just like jumping into various pop sessions down there. And there's a bunch of songs that'll be coming out over the next 6 months or so. Yeah, I don't know. All sorts of shit, man.
A lot of stuff, man. And that's another compliment I can afford you, because a lot of people, they only want to talk to me when they have an album coming out next Friday. So the fact that you just wanted to kick it, talk about music and life, it was awesome, man. We covered a lot of ground. I appreciate you being an early bird and giving up some of your valuable time to kick it with me.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for taking the time. I appreciate it.